We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of Focus, we'll be spending some time looking at the history of modern Turkey. Our guest for the program is Carter Findlay. He is the Humanities Distinguished Professor of History at Ohio State University. He is an expert on Turkish studies. He focuses on the Ottoman period. He is the author of a recently published book, which looks at the development of modern Turkey, and the title is Turkey, Islam, Nationalism, and Modernity. It's published by the Yale University Press. Turkey is a predominantly Muslim country. That is, about 97% of the population is Muslim. It is also a secular state, and that is something that many, many Turkish people point to with great pride as an important defining characteristic of their nation. And often, as that story has been told, as people have talked about how it is that we get from the Ottoman Empire to the modern Turkish state, they present this as a kind of linear, orderly progression that moves from one to the other. And our guest this morning, Carter Findlay, says that, in fact, as the Ottoman Empire weakened, there were really two currents of change that came together. And there was a kind of a dialogue. And on one hand, we do have that we're maybe more familiar with, one that is more radical and more secular. But there is also another that is more conservative and Islamic. And he says it really was the convergence, the coming together of these two things that made Turkey's survival and development possible. And that is what he discusses in his book, Turkey, Islam, Nationalism, and Modernity. Questions certainly are welcome. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And also, it's possible for people to send in emails if you're interested in making your comments that way. You can do that by writing to will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So if you'd like to be a part of the conversation, you can certainly do that. And Professor Findlay, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Maybe to start out with, you could talk just a little bit more about the sort of more conventional story that gets told about the formation of modern Turkey and how it is that it came to be the place that it is, particularly the fact that it is an officially secular state and a place where people point to that as being an important defining feature of their state.
The conventional understanding of this.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I'm quite familiar with it because when I entered the field, it was the reigning orthodoxy, and the books that established it were all newly published. They were the new books that I was struggling to read at the time. And they basically, it was a contrast put together out of the obvious differentiating terms. On one hand, you had an Islamic multinational empire that fell apart and was replaced by this new dynamic secular national republic. And the Islamic Empire was eastward oriented, and the secular republic was westward oriented. And Western understandings of modernity included ideas about secularism. Actually, what the Young Turk intellectuals had their eyes on was more like the French anti-clericalism of about 1905. So it's the French style, what's known as laicism in France. And more, not just that, but the elites who led this transformation from empire to republic were mostly people trained in the military and civil academies that the late Ottoman sultans had created to form new elites to help try to save the empire. And particularly in the military medical school, these guys training had a school of thought that was known in Europe as scientific materialism. It became very big in it. And this was it also spread in across Europe and into America. The leading writers about it were sort of popular science writers in Germany, like Ludwig Büchner is the best-known name. His book, Force and Matter, was read everywhere in the 19th century, at least by materialist people interested in materialism. Well, that certainly included the Ottoman elites, and they thought this was the picture of the future. And so the understandings of modernity in the 1960s really had this idea in them that the influence of religion would decline as modernity progressed, and societies would become increasingly secular. It's an odd circumstance that people thought like this, because the founders of sociology, people like Emile Durkheim in France, were, of course, very much interested in religion and wrote about religion and certainly seemed to think it was a normal part of society. But be that as it may, the ideas, the understanding of modernity that got enshrined or are assimilated by the modernizing Turkish elite pictured this laic future for the country. And so the books that were written and that emerged out of this whole process depicted a linear trajectory from this collapsing Islamic multinational empire that, you know, was obsolete and couldn't be defeated. You know, people wanted to preserve the empire, but they couldn't preserve that kind of a structure. And so it had to be replaced. And when it became inevitable to replace it, the thing to do was to create a modern secular state in its place. Mm-hmm. That was the reigning orthodoxy. That was the state of the art in the, say, the 1960s.
So they were saying that in the 1960s, they were thinking that there somehow was this important relationship between modernity and secularism, and did though the Young Turks, Ataturk and the other people who formed the state, did they also think that there was this very important relationship between modernity and secularism?
Well, in a word, yes. Ataturk would, in public, when it was expedient, he would, you know, stand there and hold his hands up while some imam said a prayer on some occasion when that sort of thing seemed needed. But in private, he was quite scornful of religion. The policies of the Young Turk elite, who dominated the last years of the empire, and the early Republican elite of the 1920s and 30s, and essentially they're the same people, their policies were sort of like the anti-clericalism of early 20th century France, but their attitudes toward religion were really just about Leninist. Hmm. They really were that negative about it in their thinking, but they had enough practical sense not to push that far in policy.
Well, now you're making an argument that in fact that this kind of story we have this sort of solid orderly linear progression from the Ottoman Empire to modern Turkey, that in fact there was much more of a dialogue between really two strains, that one, which certainly was there, but also one that one could characterize as more conservative and more Islamic.
Yes, that's the biggest single new thing about my book. I mean, it's not that other people haven't anticipated this idea in some way, but I don't think anybody has traced it across two centuries yet. Mm-hmm. And when you take that a sort of panoramic view across that wide of a time scale, you can see, certainly by the 1970s, it was obvious that religion was not going to just fade away. and not only in the Islamic world, there was certainly the Islamic resurgence there, which was not felt much right at first in Turkey, but sooner or later it was, and then around the world in general. I mean, the USA has also had a sort of religious resurgence in a lot of ways, and so this is, I think, a global trend. And so the classical sociologist, the founding sociologist of the Durkheim era, who thought that the sociology of religion was a legitimate part of the field, turned out to be right after all. And so by the 1970s, it was becoming apparent that this interpretation really didn't cover the whole story. But the problem was, what do you put in place of it, and how do you organize a better narrative? And it took a long time to figure that out. A lot of people had to work on specific movements or periods or figures. And it was luckily for me that the little stream of graduate students I have coming to me, they sort of changed color from red to green. And green in Turkey is the color associated with Islam. So I had fewer leftists and more people who are involved in religious movements. And sooner or later, I had somebody identified with or interested in every single Islamic movement in Turkey. And so I began working with them and trying to figure out, well, if we wanted to have some sort of different chronology, what would be the chronology in the religious history of the country or in the realm of conservative thought. Some of those people actually are pretty secular. Some of the novelists are cultural conservatives, but pretty much never talk about religion. It's quite interesting. But anyway, we started trying to figure out what were the sort of main events there. And as time went by, I began to notice that in books about the 19th century, there was this one religious movement that kept getting mentioned over and over again. In the early Republic, there was this one religious thinker who just was denounced and villainized as, you know, reactionary and an enemy of the Republic and all that kind of stuff. Then you got up to the 1980s, and there's another religious movement that's particularly successful. And this began to suggest to me that actually it made me think of the Great Awakening theme that's used in the history of the early American Republic, this waves of religious enthusiasm that swept across the land. Late Ottoman and Republican Turkish history also has three religious movements that just had a bigger influence than others. They weren't the only ones, but they were the ones who made waves in their particular periods. And so that was the starting point for a realization that there was a sort of dialectical, you know, gradually different approaches to modernity formed and differentiated. It takes quite a while, actually. And that in the long run, there was a sort of dialectical action between them. And, you know, that's nothing Marxist about that, at least not in this particular analysis. It really is sort of like a reaction between two different trends that, you know, sometimes they clash and conflict, and sometimes they converge and borrow elements from each other, and gradually the whole debate sort of moves forward and assumes new forms as time goes by.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think actually the transition from empire to republic, or just to put it this way, the mere fact that a Turkish polity survived in 1918 probably is due to the fact that these different trends didn't only conflict, they also converged and reinforced each other at certain points. If they hadn't, it wouldn't have just been the Ottoman Empire that would have collapsed. It probably would have not been any sort of Turkish successor state either.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Carter Findlay. He's professor of history at The Ohio State University. His area of interest is the history of Islamic civilization, a particular emphasis on the Ottoman Empire and the modern Middle East. And he is the author of the book Turkey, Islam, Nationalism, and Modernity. This covers the period between 1789 and 2000. It's published by the Yale University Press. And questions, certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, if you go back and you look at
the people who are part of the conservative Islamic current here, did they, what sort of vision did they have for a modern Turkish state? And was it significantly different from the kind of state that the secularists had in mind?
Well, in the long run, it would have to be, because the secularists, part of their thought world really is materialist and secularist in that sense. They picture modernity as a secular materialist thing. And for the religious people or cultural conservatives, this is, of course, troubling. Also, one of the things that happened is the as time went by, especially the partisans of secular modernity, the more radical wing of this Turkish world. A lot of those people were the kind of people who valued change for its own sake, and so the idea of you know, just overturning anything that was old and replacing it with something new, like, you know, even changing the words and the language and things like that, that they built up a lot of momentum in favor of doing that sort of thing, and it causes a lot of unease on the part of people who you know, attach more value to what they had before. The secularizers tended to develop a more rapid, less reflective approach to emulating the West. And the cultural conservatives were actually the people who were more likely to look at things in fine detail, compare European and Ottoman Islamic ways of doing things in all kinds of little details, like, you know, whether it was better to eat at a dining table with knives and forks rather than sitting around a circular tray on a stand the way people used to do, and compare the details about dress and social relations, and look into the fine details about the status of women in Europe as opposed to that in the Ottoman world. And of course, in the 1800s, it was not all in favor of the way things were for women in Europe. So the conservatives were the ones who actually they. What I want to emphasize here is that both of them are modernity becomes something you can't escape. It's not as if in the 1960s we used to think they were modernizers and traditionalists. Well, traditionalist is maybe okay if what you mean by that is cultural conservatives, but if what you mean by that is people who simply don't want to have anything to do with modernity, in the Ottoman Empire, by the very early 1800s, there was no place to hide from modernity. The first of these major religious movements actually started in Iraqi Kurdistan. And one reason it started was because the disequilibrating effects of increased interaction with the outside world were already being felt even in a place like that. Missionaries were showing up and starting to provide services at differential levels to non-Muslims as opposed to Muslims. This was unsettling historic communal relations. Trade was increasing. Communications up the Tigris and Euphrates, steamboats were being introduced and things like that. So even in a place like this, and also the empire was being affected by things like the Greek Revolution in the 1820s, people reacted to that, to events like that all over the empire. And so even in a backwoods part of the Ottoman Empire, like what's now northern Iraq, you get reactions to change, and as a matter of actual fact, that's where the first of these big waves emerged from. So, but all of these people they're all offering some kind of approach to modernity.
Well, we have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who is in Urbana and line one right here. Hello.
Hello. fascinating topic you have today. I spent 2 weeks in Turkey this past June and enjoyed myself a great deal. And I felt a kind of energy there. The group we were with, we were in several homes for meals and had a fair amount of contact with people in three different areas of Turkey. But it reminded me of being in Japan 20 years ago when the people in Japan had a great deal of optimism and they were proud of being Japanese. I found that Turkish people proud of being Turkish. I just found the country very invigorating. We were guests of groups that are broadly affiliated with Fethullah Gulen, and I'm trying to read and learn more about him. Could you comment on him and this straddle between a kind of modernity, but also he's part of a kind of religious renewal movement? And when I read stuff about him, even though his own comments are oftentimes quite opaque, I find him a polarizing figure, so that you find people who think he's a stooge of the CIA. You find people who think that he's secretly going to impose a very hardcore Islamist state. And all the while, he's sitting in Pennsylvania as some sort of a recluse. So could you give me your take on Gulen and this broad movement that he has spawned? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Yes. Fethullah Gulen is the third of these three major figures, and his movement is the third of the three big waves that I was talking about. One of the problems that you can see in European and eventually American sources about the late Ottoman Empire of modern Turkey is that foreigners and non-Muslims usually have a very limited set of terms at their disposal to use in commenting on developments in the Islamic world. And there is, I know of a specific example of a Ottoman statesman of the 1830s who was actually very important in the modernizing trends at that period. I think the first time I ever saw him mentioned, it was in a British diplomatic dispatch of the period where he was described as a fanatic. Well, fanatic was one of the few words that Englishmen of the 1830s used to could think of to describe a Muslim who was religious in some way. But, of course, it doesn't mean he was a fanatic. He was actually a supporter of the first of these waves that I was talking about, and a man of great culture and very important in the diplomatic relations with Europe, which the Ottoman Empire really depended on in that period. And Gulen, I think, is like that. The idea that he wants to impose, strict Sharia law in Turkey or something like this, his secular opponents in Turkey will say things like that. And of course, people in the USA, one of our big problems is that our interest in Turkey and other Middle Eastern countries, most of the time, it doesn't really go beyond thinking of them as tourist destinations or problems in U.S. foreign policy. And especially when they're thought of the latter way, then pretty much anything that happens out there is makes us think that things are getting out of control and we've got to do something about it. And so it's only a step from there to armed intervention and stuff like that. So I think one of the things is our problem is we don't have a sufficiently fine-grained screen on which to interpret a movement like this. The Gulen movement is represents a whole new stage in these religious movements. It's not just offering Muslims inside of Turkey a way to deal with the modern world, which the earlier movements were very much oriented to doing that. It also, its real spread starts after about 1983, and it represents a successful adaptation to the post-Soviet era and to the era of globalization. A lot of its zone of expansion has been in the Turkic republics of Central Asia, but it has really gone global, and it has run into problems with the secular authorities in Turkey, Well, all of these movements, the leaders of all of these movements, you can't be a really big religious figure in Turkey, and I think in a lot of Muslim countries, without running into problems with the state authorities. Those two just kind of go together. Rulers tend to be antsy about anybody who is getting too big and are getting too much influence that competes with theirs. And so all of these movements have lived through that. And the fact that Gulen lives in Pennsylvania is, you know, a result of that. He was put on trial and accused of being an enemy of secularism and things like that. These are sort of overreactions on the part of the secular authorities in Turkey. And one of the problems they've got is they, as their influence sort of passes its peak, they began to react in pretty rigid ways to changes that didn't really conform to their program. And Gulen would be one of the biggest of those. His movement has, what stands out about it to me is that they contributed a great deal in the areas of character formation. The people who work in the movement, you described the people you met in these homes, they are really wonderful people who are very much dedicated to the ideal of service, which more and more is what they identify their movement with. And they also push the dialogue and interfaith communications thing very far in an effort to build bridges and to make people understand that, that they're somehow not a threat. One of the things about the Gulen movement in the USA that's a little bit funny when you first hear about it, sounds a little bit funny, is in cities where they start being active, characteristically, one of the first things they'll do is invite the local head of the FBI to come meet with them. Well, you know, it sounds far-fetched, but if you want to avoid suspicions that you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, maybe that's a way to do it. And in Chicago recently, on the occasion of one of the big Islamic festivals, that there's a folk custom of giving out dishes of a certain kind of pudding on that day. So they had a public event and gave out thousands of dishes of pudding to the FBI people in Chicago. I mean, when you talk about outreach, they do things like that in addition to forming schools and really mobilizing a lot of people. As an engagement with modernity, it really is one of the things that's happened with it. It has Turkey is a country with, I would say, a pretty weak tradition of philanthropy and civic engagement. And the Gulen movement, and before it also I think the movement it grew out of, has been very significant in getting people to commit themselves to public service and philanthropic causes. And it has also played a very important role in getting conservative business interests who were historically suspicious of banks and would, you know, keep their assets in gold or something like that, getting them to invest their resources in productive enterprises that become part of the, you know, this whole spectrum of Gulen activities. And then they also produce profits that these people invest in philanthropic causes. And it started with very basic things like providing better housing for university students in Turkey. So it's a very significant and very benign movement. My own impression about it is that it potentially is as significant for the 21st century as the Gandhi movement was for the 20th. It's, of course, going to take time to see whether that really is true or not, but it could be.
Hmm. I think this is really fascinating, and it makes me think of concerns I think perhaps some people in Europe, in Western Europe and the United States have when they see growing interest in the practice of Islam in Turkey. They wonder what, if anything, that means. I think that people in Turkey say that, well, as far as they're concerned, they think that that's significant. And maybe one of the things that's significant about it is the fact that people are doing it not because the government is telling them to,
but because this is their choice and they're drawn to it, and they and still they seem to have a very strong sense of wanting their country to continue to be a secular state, and which makes it all, I think, for us rather difficult and confusing to think about what that means.
Well, I think it's challenging for us to understand it because it requires us to try to learn a little bit more about their situation than, you know, most of us get around to doing in the daily course of our lives. I mean, I'm not criticizing most Americans for not knowing a great deal about Turkey. If you're, you know, trying to make a living and support your family, having this kind of knowledge about other countries is a big challenge. But I think one of the things that's interesting about it is that their assimilation, and as far as I can tell, this is sincere. I've heard it articulated by people who are quite high up, both in religious circles in Turkey and in the government. This is in itself as an example of this dialectic between the two different approaches to modernity. At a stage, really religious people in Turkey would have wanted an Islamic state. I mean, the Ottoman Empire was officially an Islamic state. It was supposed to be that way. And they worked very hard to do that. The Republic, you know, when that order couldn't be maintained any longer, the secularizing radicals were sort of like the men on horseback who rode in to save the day, and the period right around 1919 and 1920. And that got this idea of a secular republic installed. And, of course, a lot of other people who weren't really ready for secularism got swept along with that because those were the guys who could save the day. And, you know, in a moment of crisis, you follow decisive leaders, even if, you know, without asking too many questions about their policies. And then later on, some sort of a dialogue or interaction happens. And already in the Islamist press by the 1960s, the idea was being articulated that secularism was a style of government in a country where most of the people were Muslims. And it turns out this is really a pretty good way to do things because it enables, it makes it possible to accommodate the secularists and the people like the Gulen movement. And then the other thing that usually gets swept under the rug is that Turkey has a very large Muslim religious minority. The percentage of the population that they represent is controversial, but you will certainly hear numbers like 15% to 20% offered as the size of this community who are known in Turkey as Alevis. It's a traditionally sort of folk religion kind of thing that is unorthodox in the sense of not observing the forms of Sharia law and the forms of worship that are prescribed there. And in fact, the movement was historically scorned by both Sunnis and Shiis. But it has a very important place in Turkish folk culture because a lot of Turks regard as the greatest Turkish folk poetry is actually the Alevi hymnal. It's text that they sing in their ceremonies. And so one of the reasons Turkey needs secularism is because it has not only the secular religious divide, but it also has religious difference in a way that the Sunni majority tries not to acknowledge. Hmm. But the fact is it's there, and it's becoming more harder to ignore because these people no longer live out in the countryside. They've moved into the cities, and they're getting more education, and they're becoming more visible and assertive.
Let me just introduce again our guest for anybody who may have tuned in the last little bit. Carter Findley is the Humanities Distinguished Professor of History at Ohio State University. He has written extensively on Turkish studies. He is particularly interested in the history of Islamic civilization, the Ottoman Empire, and the modern Middle East, and is the author of a book that is recently out. It's titled Turkey, Islam, Nationalism, and Modernity, a History, covering this period between 1789 and 2007. It's published by the Yale University Press, which, as we have discussed, offers a more complicated and interesting kind of story, looking at how it is that Turkey moves from the late Ottoman Empire and eventually becomes the state that we now know, and how it is that really two streams of thought, one that indeed was secular, more radical and secular, how there was a dialogue between that stream and one that was really more conservative and Islamic, and that has the importance of that stream and the kind of dialogue between the two, the way that dialogue formed the contemporary Turkish state, something that he argues really hasn't been acknowledged to the extent that it should. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested because I read a little article about you and about Ohio State, and know that you've been involved in there at Ohio State in developing courses on Islamic history and Middle Eastern language and so forth, which maybe early on didn't have the kind of support that it does now. I guess I was very struck, in fact, in by this story that at some time, maybe it was in the 1960s, that you were involved in trying to raise money so that you could buy Turkish books for the OSU library, and that the library director at the time said he didn't want any Turkish books in his library. I wondered, what was it this man, was it that they were Turkish, that was the problem, or that they were not in English was the problem, or that he apparently just thought, well, I don't know, I only have so much shelf space and there's not going to be very much demand for this? Or did that also say something about what people thought about Turkish studies at the time?
Well, hey, look, you're in the Midwest, and actually I haven't been at Ohio State since the 60s. I've been here since the early 70s, however.
Oh, okay.
And that's when this occurred.
Okay.
It was one of my first experiences in trying to boost Turkish studies at Ohio State, and I got the local community to donate some money to buy books, and then I had a chance to see the library director someplace one day, and in passing, I mentioned to him that we now had these books in the library, and he just popped up and said, "I don't want any Turkish books in my library." Well, for people who live in the Midwest and you know how people used to regard Ohio State, that's just echt Ohio State of the period. I mean, it didn't get either much better or much worse than that. That was about average for Ohio State in that period. So it was. It shows how far we have come. This guy used to ride around on a motorcycle, and the best thing I can say about him is at one point he got on his motorcycle and just rode off. And we've had more professional library directors since then.
I see.
I think he was surprised to discover that there were books in the library that weren't all in English. I mean, I don't really know what his thinking was. It was a little sign to me about how far I had to go to build a program.
Well, even, you know, as recently as 10 years ago, I think that people were bemoaning the fate of Middle Eastern studies in this country. And I wonder whether you think that things are much more improved now.
Well, there was a wave of criticism at a stage because people thought that it wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. There was some of this was... I think was connected to critiques that came out of Israel, where the Middle East studies people really are sort of organically connected with the government, and national security priorities shape academic research in a way that would not be considered normal here. And so from that point of view, you could critique the usefulness of a lot of what people do. But now, one of the things about a situation where freedom of thought is really prioritized is all kind of crazy stuff happens, and later you find out which of it was useful, or which of it really, you know, led to something else, to some later flowering. And so trying to tell people in advance how they should do their work is not really what American scholarship has been based on, and it hasn't really produced the best results in other fields of endeavor. So I don't think it would do it in Middle Eastern studies either. There are never enough people. Any given program doesn't have enough professors or enough language courses to really do it adequately. We'd have to make the same kind of investment in Middle Eastern history that we make in American history, and there has never been a U.S. university that did that, and it's kind of hard to imagine that there would be.
Hmm. Well, we have a couple of callers here and about 10 minutes left, so we'll get back to the phones, and let's go to Peoria to start out with. Line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My Americans love the Sufis, and my son was in Turkey for a while, and he visited Rumi's grave. But I haven't listened to the whole program. Maybe you've talked about this today, but I thought that Turkey had either persecuted or outlawed the Sufis and the more conservative Muslims are persecuting the Sufis even in Pakistan. They're blowing up shrines and stuff. So I didn't know what Turkey's position was. The center, the grave, is still there, but did they outlaw the Sufis, or is that related to the Alevi that you were talking about? I'll just let you talk.
Okay. Well, is that something you can talk about, Professor Griffin?
Yes. The Turkish Republic early on passed a lot of secularizing laws which were designed to dismantle the things that had made Islam the official religion of the Ottoman Empire, and one of the things they did was pass a law ordering the Sufi meeting halls to close. So they had to close and lock their doors. And what that did was it forced these movements underground, and some of them were better able to survive under those circumstances than others. It of course, did not mean that the movements didn't survive. And what has happened in recent years is there has been increasing tolerance. And starting in the 1980s, you had the first prime minister who would openly identify himself as being both half Kurdish and a member of the Naqshbandi Sufi order. And indeed, he's a follower of the branch of it that is the first of these three big awakenings I'm talking about. And so there's been increasing tolerance of them. Another piece of the picture that you need to know is that the Sufi Brotherhood, as organizations and as a sort of model for organizing things, I think even among religious people, a lot of people thought that this was a model that had passed its time. It wasn't as useful for the future as it had been in the past. And of course, the more people got into going back to studying Islam from the Quran and the really basic texts, the more they realized that a lot of these orders had very heterodox practices. Some of them were strict about observing Sharia law, and some of them just didn't give a hoot. And so they had sort of like the spectrum of that you see in religious sects in the USA in terms of proximity and distance to, you know, Christian tradition or whatever standard you might posit. And so by the time that law was passed in 1925, it was not only the secularists, but also a lot of the religious people who thought that, maybe closing these Sufi meeting halls was really not a bad thing. And it's not surprising that the two of the big religious movements that have developed since then, both the Nur Si movement and the Gulen movement, they represent new organizational forms as well as new waves of Islamic revivalism. Saeed Nur Si, who was the great religious thinker of the early Republican period, which was, boy, if you want to have a tough sledding as a religious intellectual, that was the time for it. He was interested in writing treatises about Islam, and have people get together to study his writings. And so you didn't join a movement. You became a disciple of his by studying his writings. And the real essence of things was the writings. So a transition to a text-based movement. And then the Gulen movement, which really grows out of he's the most influential of Nursi's successors, is what really happened there. That's more interested in public service and action than it is in studying the text, although, of course, they still do that. And part of Gulen's eminence is that he knows so much about the Quran and the writings of Nursi. I mean, that's really... and his personal example, those are the things that give him the charisma he's got, as far as I can see. So the religious movements themselves express the idea that the Sufi Brotherhood, I mean, the message of the Sufi Brotherhood and the kind of forms of religious experience that they promote, like the whirling, the ceremonies of the Mevlevi Dervishes, for example, and the poetical texts that those are based on, all of those have lasting value that's independent of, you know, having a place where you get together on Thursday night, kiss the hand of the sheikh, and perform certain rites. And a lot of the customs and beliefs and practices that were associated with that organized form of Sufism, you know, a lot of people thought it was time to move beyond that.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have some other callers. We'll try to get at least one more. We'll go to Champaign County, line one.
Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, I should have called earlier, but... This figure that you're talking about as the first awakening, who's half Kurdish, strikes me as needing, I don't know, more explanation than we can have in this time. I mean, the Kurds have always been a disenfranchised minority. Maybe there was a time when it didn't matter so much. And I mean, in the 90s, the U.S. paid for a genocidal campaign against the Kurds, and go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Ottoman Empire was an Islamic state, and its population was very, very heterogeneous ethnically. And as long as Islam was the big identifier and, you know, ethnic or linguistic difference was not very salient, the Kurds were quite happy. They might have economic or political or local issues of some kind or another, but in terms of being unhappy about living under Ottoman rule, they weren't. It's actually the creation of a secular Turkish republic that made the Kurds all of a sudden sit up and say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? And so in the period of Ataturk, there was somewhere between 10 and 20 rebellions against the early Turkish republic, and almost all of them occurred out in southeastern Anatolia. At the same time, the leader, the Said Nursi, the leading religious activist of that period, was a Kurd who was writing all these treatises I talked about in his peculiar form of Turkish. It's kind of a Kurdish-inflected Turkish, I guess you could say, and or Ottoman-inflected Turkish. And he was busily saying, still, Kurds and Turks are brothers. And, of course, Muslims think of it that way. The more people are religious, the less among Muslims nationalism is. Islam and nationalism, in principle, don't go together. You can't say that they don't ever at all. But when people are doing what they're supposed to do, they don't go together. And so these this kind of difference gets hot in some situations, and in others it's not. And in Turkey today, to understand Turkish-Kurdish relations, you cannot look only at the PKK. You have to also look at the fact that you have people like this prime minister of the 80s, the most influential statesman since Ataturk, came out in public and said he was the Turkish son of a Kurdish mother. So there's really quite a spectrum to this. And the fact that one of the leading religious thinkers of the early 1800s was Kurdish, well, he was the leading Islamic thinker, and that's really what people reacted to. He wrote in Arabic, and his influence spread in Iraq and Syria, and then the Ottoman elites in Istanbul got interested in it, and it turns out the movement actually had more of a history up in that in the Turkish-speaking zone than in the Arabic lands.
We're at the point where we're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say. We maybe have about a minute or so left. I guess as a way of finishing, I'm interested in whether you think that that looking at what happened in modern Turkey helps any at all people other places who are trying to negotiate what is seen as this conflict between modernizers and conservatives, where conservatives end up being defined as people who essentially don't want to have anything to do with the modern world.
Well, the best short answer I can give is that Islamic modernist thinkers and activists in other countries do look at Turkey. And in Egypt, for example, there's intellectuals in places like Tunisia. Rashid Ghannouchi has been impressed with events in Turkey. But in Egypt, too, the enemies of the Mubarak regime, most of whom are Islamic activists, if they were, you know, gotten in, drawn into a discussion about whether they would, accept cooperating with a democratic system, if there was one, they said, well, you know, we've seen that the religious people were able to win elections in Turkey in 2002 and 2007, so maybe that would work for us too. There is, you can't just take what, you can't just transplant things from Turkey to other countries, but there is a sort of emulation potential. I don't know how far it's going to go, but there are at least people who are looking and saying, well, you know, maybe we could learn something from this. Maybe this could work for us, too.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. If you're interested in reading some about the history of modern Turkey, you can look at the book Turkey, Islam, Nationalism, and Modernity by our guest Carter Findlay. It's published by the Yale University Press. Carter Findlay is the Humanities Distinguished Professor of History at Ohio State University. And Professor Findlay, thank you very much for talking with us today.
And thank you.